We've been talking about terrorism. And specifically, in the discussion of terrorism, we've been talking about provocation. In Radio Free America number 4, we talked about the Triple Wilson operation to Libya. One of the main players on the terrorist stage in the last 15 years or so has, of course, been Libyan head of state Muammar Gaddafi, who now officially disowns terrorism and, by most accounts, has moved away from the terrorism, which was one of the major hallmarks of his regime. However, it should be noted that although Gaddafi is portrayed as a Soviet dupe, in fact, the geniture of Gaddafi's terrorism goes back to the U.S. National Security Establishment. In Radio Free America number 4, we took a look at the Triple Wilson operation, which, although they were represented as being ex-CIA agents, in fact, they were not ex-CIA agents at all. In fact, Theodore Shackley, one of the main members of what the Christic Institute refers to as the secret team, stated as much in an article which is included in Radio Free America number 4, that from Gung Ho magazine in June of 1982. Gung Ho is a mercenary publication similar in scope and function to Soldier of Fortune, and in an article called High Stakes Mercs, the author, a fellow named J. David Truby, quotes Theodore Shackley as stating in no uncertain terms that the Triple Wilson operation was an active duty CIA operation, which comes as no surprise to most of the people, the veteran political researchers who had studied that particular operation. It should be noted that the geniture of Gaddafi's CIA goes back to the same Skorzeny-Galen CIA mission to the Middle East, which first founded the Egyptian General Staff and Secret Service, and then eventually went on to produce the Libyan Secret Service as well. The CIA and Galen dispatched a number of ex-Third Reich people, including many heinous war criminals associated with Hitler's liquidation of the Jews, and they formed the Egyptian Secret Service and General Staff. They also later put together the Libyan Secret Service as well, which got most of the training and arms for its terrorist cadre from the CIA and the U.S. National Security Establishment in the person of Messrs. Wilson and Turple. In Radio Free America number 32, we took a look at the Rex 84 Martial Law Contingency Plan, which was being drawn up by members of the secret team, Oliver North and Company. This would have provided for the institution of martial law in the United States in the event of, among other incidents, a terrorist incident. And one of the things that we looked at in Radio Free America 32 was the ominous connections between Oliver North and Company and many of the very terrorists who could have served as the pretext for the institution of Rex 84. And again, we're looking at this in the context of provocation and in the context of the Reichstag scenario. Now, going back again, because we're recounting a lot of information, recall now the Aria deal, brokered by Manzar El-Kassar, drug dealer and terrorist weapons supplier to, among others, Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas, two of the key players on the international terrorist stage during 1985 and 86. In an article that appeared in the New York Times of January 7th of 1989, the suspicion that I had was confirmed. This article came out the day before the first half of this broadcast, but as is often the case, my newspapers had begun backing up, and I did not read this until afterwards. But in fact, some of the key documents figuring in Oliver North's national security defense, as it's called, were indeed documents pertaining to the Aria shipment. And again, that shipment brokered in part not only by Skorzeny protege Gerhard Mertens' Merex Corporation, a BND front. It also was brokered by Manzar El-Kassar, a terrorist and drug dealer associated with Abu Abbas and Abu Nidal. Also, interestingly enough, a former member of the company, quote-unquote, an arms-for-drug-smuggling ring, which apparently is indeed part of the company, quote-unquote, the CIA, or at least works with it. One of the key players there was a fellow named James Atwood. He was involved with the company. He also was involved with the Aria shipment. The judge who heard one of the key aspects of the company's operations, namely the assassination of Judge Wood in Texas, was the former judge William Sessions, now head of the FBI, and the fellow who was very much involved in the bust of Pizza Connection 4. And remember the scenario of freezing the linebackers that we looked at last week. When Pizza Connection 4 broke, an awful lot of people have to have been looking over their shoulder, both in this country and in and around the Mediterranean. That would have made a lot of this country's hottest terrorist connections very, very sensitive due to the Stibom connection that I went into last week and that I outlined earlier in the broadcast this evening. And again, some of the key documents in Oliver North's national security defense did indeed pertain to the area. This from an article in the New York Times of January 7th of 1989. It's an article by Michael Wines, W-I-N-E-S, Dateline Washington, headlined, Top Reagan Aides Knew North Case Faced Collapse. Subheaded, Warning Given by Walsh, Detailed Plea for Documents Was Denied Unanimously by Six-Member Panel. And skipping down in the story, the key part about the area reads as follows. Two officials said the panel and Mr. Walsh disagreed in that period over a number of issues, including the use of some documents covering intelligence operations and other items already disclosed by news-gathering organizations. One result of those battles, officials said, was a decision by Mr. Walsh last month to drop his efforts to prosecute Mr. North on a wide array of private intelligence operations, still secret, that he supervised and apparently financed with proceeds from the Iran arms sales. For example, one official said, Mr. Walsh sought to use evidence that Mr. North purchased a Danish ship, the Aria, and used it in unauthorized intelligence missions, including shipping arms to the Nicaraguan rebels and attempting to acquire a Soviet tank. One official said Mr. Walsh was denied access to intelligence gathered about the ship, although many of its ventures had been widely publicized. A second official called that view nonsense, but added that Mr. Walsh was not allowed to use documents indicating that the ship was involved in operations, quote, that would have revealed U.S. activities of a similar nature, unquote. Excuse me, that last sentence again. A second official called the view nonsense, but added that Mr. Walsh was not allowed to use documents indicating that the ship was involved in operations, quote, that would have revealed U.S. activities of a similar nature. One of the hypotheses that I have been proceeding on is that, in fact, the most significant aspect of the Manzer El-Kassar Aria Merex connection was the fact that it would have revealed, had all of the information come out, if not direct U.S. sponsorship, U.S. complicity in and tolerance of some of the terrorist outrages not only in calendar years 85 and 86, but both before and afterward. And again, I think one of the pivotal breakthrough points of the late May Brussels research was her revelation that, in fact, provocation, the deliberate setting up of terrorist incidents, was a major fact of contemporary American political life. It is my opinion that the Manzer El-Kassar connection here and the U.S. and secret team sponsorship of terrorism is what had to be withheld, because frequently, as we've looked at so many times in the past, terrorism and counterterrorism are inextricably linked, and not as opponents, frequently as strange, albeit appropriate, bedfellows. Some of the archive shows dealing with terrorism, with provocation, with the Triple Wilson operation, Radio Free America number 4, Radio Free America shows 19, 20, and 21, Radio Free America show 25, Radio Free America shows 30, 31, 32, and 34, in particular the supplements to 34. Also, a program called The Fascist Third Position, a two-part series done last summer. Also, last but certainly not least, I almost forgot, Radio Free America number 22, dealing at great length with Otto Skorzeny, the CIA's Skorzeny, the Third Reich's Skorzeny, and his pivotal influence on the course of world terrorism. As I mentioned last week, an article was discovered by a listener in the Los Angeles Times which links the name of Edwin Wilson, the mastermind of the Libyan operation, the Gaddafi operation, supposedly an ex-CIA agent, but as we've seen, not an ex-CIA agent at all. His name surfaced in connection with the bombing of Flight 103 in Lockerbie, Scotland, on December 21st of last year. Now, it is a major tenet of the working hypothesis that I'm presenting here that it was the bombing of Flight 103 which, among other things, killed several key U.S. counterterrorist experts and which was described as being the type of incident which intimidated U.S. and CIA counterterrorist experts. It not only killed them, thereby sealing potentially some lips which could have revealed a lot of information about one aspect or another of the Iran-Contra scandal. Remember, counterterrorism and terrorism are very closely linked. It also, I think, may have very well served to freeze the linebackers, as I indicated last week, to hold linebackers being a metaphor for key players in this scandal. I think a lot of lips remain sealed as the result of Flight 103 that might otherwise have spoken. Beyond that, and perhaps even more significantly, once the name of Abu Nidal and Middle Eastern terrorism in general surfaced in connection with Flight 103, thereby any documents at all relating to Mideast terrorism, to counterterrorism, to Abu Nidal, to Manzar al-Qasar, to Abu Abbas, to Steebaum, to the shooting of the Pope, all of those documents would have become the most sensitive documents in the U.S. national security establishment, because at that point the search was on. Who set off the bomb? Initially, the reports were that it was Abu Nidal, who surfaced in Lebanon a few days after the explosion. Now it's being said that it was the Islamic Jihad, an Iranian terrorist group. It remains to be seen. It is one of the major aspects of my working hypothesis here, that in fact the bombing of Flight 103 was the pivotal element in the December surprise and thereby necessitated the dismissal of the charges against Oliver North, because the documents could not have been released relating to the various aspects of Middle Eastern terrorism that I've just been discussing. In Radio Free America number 30, the second broadcast in a six-part Radio Free America series about the Iran-Contra scandal, the fact that it was the Turple Wilson team, the people like Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, Rafael Chichi Quintero, and others, this is the group that was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. And again, that's hardly my original thesis, but people can deal with that in Radio Free America number 30. It's received a lot of publicity. So in light of all of this, and there are other aspects to the crash of the explosion of Flight 103, the fact that a top Justice Department Nazi hunter was killed, the fact that the UN administrator for Namibia was killed, whereas Rolof Piek Botha, the South African foreign minister who was to have signed that agreement, the Angola Accord and Namibian Accord with Bernd Carlson, he was going to be on the flight, but he got off. Was he warned? Wouldn't be surprising. We can't say for sure, but certainly I think it is suspicious that Bernd Carlson went down, and now he got burnt, so to speak, and Piek Botha managed to change his flight. A very lucky fellow, if luck is indeed what it was. Interesting, though, as I said, that the name of Edwin Wilson should have emerged in connection with the downing of Flight 103. Research credit on this goes to a listener reading now from the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, December 28th of 1988. It's a story by Charles P. Wallace of the Los Angeles Times. It's Dateline Nicosia, Cyprus, headlined, Abu Nidal reportedly visits Lebanese base to say goodbye to two young hostages. Abu Nidal, the world's most wanted terrorist and a possible suspect in last week's crash of a Pan Am jumbo jet in Scotland, was reported Tuesday to have made a rare appearance in Lebanon. A spokesman for Abu Nidal's guerrilla group, Revolutionary Council of Fatah, said the terrorist, whose real name is Sabri Bana, B-A-N-N-A, had visited a secret base in Lebanon to say farewell to two kidnapped French girls who were about to be released by the organization. Interrupting, we took a look at that last week. Skipping down on the story, Syria last year closed down Abu Nidal's offices in Damascus after coming under international pressure, but the Revolutionary Council of Fatah openly maintains offices in Tripoli, the Libyan capital. Tensions have been rising in recent days between Libya and the United States over allegations that Libya has built a factory for producing chemical weapons near Tripoli. President Reagan has said that the United States is considering what action to take, raising the possibility of a military attack. Interrupting, of course, later there was an air battle, or a dogfight, over the sea off the coast of Libya, in which two Libyan aircraft were downed under as yet undetermined circumstances. The U.S. claims they were attacking and were armed. Libya claims they weren't. It remains to be determined just what the situation is. Skipping down again in the story, Some security experts in the Middle East have cited Abu Nidal's organization as the most likely suspect in the crash of Pan Am Flight 103 in Lockerbie, Scotland last Wednesday, in which 259 people aboard the plane were killed. Excuse me. At least 10 townspeople are listed as missing and presumed dead. Although British officials have said they have no firm evidence of sabotage, a bomb is considered the most likely cause of the plane's disintegration in the air. The experts noted that Abu Nidal's group had access to a powerful plastic explosive known as Semtex H and air pressure sensitive detonation devices because they were sold to the Libyan government by former CIA agent Edwin P. Wilson, who was now serving a prison sentence in the United States. So it is fascinating that the name of Ed Wilson, one of the key, obviously the man for whom the Triple Wilson team was named, at least in our parlance here, and a key player himself on the international terrorist stage. Interesting that his name should have been mentioned in connection with this. Remember now, one of the major foci of provocation is to justify one's own actions. Again, consider the floating of the Abu Nidal name, and we don't know precisely who set off this bomb. I suspect it was us, basically, i.e. the American National Security Establishment. But interesting that Edwin Wilson's name is floated in connection with this. Wilson associated with Gaddafi, of course. Gaddafi associated with Abu Nidal. Interesting, too, that the director of the CIA, when the Triple Wilson operation was launched, none other than President-elect and current Vice President George Bush. So, again, we don't know precisely who set off the bomb. The working hypothesis here says that it was us. We have met the enemy, so to speak, and he is us. Again, fascinating that Edwin Wilson's name should have surfaced in connection with the pressure-sensitive fuse device or triggering device that apparently, at least according to demolitions experts, brought down Flight 103. That Oliver North's documents indeed would have revealed some active CIA contacts and thereby necessitating their continuing to remain secret was maintained, this was revealed in a number of different articles. Very briefly, one of them appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, January 12th of 1989. It's a story by Alfonso Chardy, who's done some great writing on the Iran-Contra scandal. Stateline Washington headlined, "Documents in North's case reportedly list CIA contacts." The secret documents withheld by the Reagan administration from the prosecution of Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North include the names of several Latin American government officials who work for the CIA and whose exposure, officials fear, would disrupt U.S. intelligence activities in several countries, sources close to the Iran-Contra probe say. Again, I wonder if perhaps some of the CIA people that would have been revealed might have been people like perhaps Manzar El-Kassar or even Abu Nidal or Abu Abbas. Again, I think the Latin American officials here is not what they were worried about. At any rate, again, Oliver North here employing what is known as the national security defense, in which basically one's work for the U.S. government is used as a defense for criminal activity. And again, it is the contention of my working hypothesis, the central feature of my working hypothesis, that when Flight 103 went down, documents relating to U.S. counter-terrorist operations in 85 and 86, U.S. Or Middle Eastern terrorism in general, would have become the hottest and the most sensitive documents in the whole U.S. national security establishment, mandating that they could not be released because they were involved in a critical, ongoing investigation. Beyond that, it's important to note, too, that public sentiment, given the horror of the Flight 103 outrage, would have been firmly against release of documents which might have been perceived to compromise such an investigation. It does not appear that the legal maneuvering in connection with Oliver North even got to that stage, but had it gotten to that stage, anything having to do with Abu Nidal, etc., would have had to have been made secret, and I think the public would have strongly supported it. Recall Ali Mania in the summer of 87, albeit a largely, I think, manufactured phenomena at first, it appears to have taken hold, at least to a certain extent. That the bombing of Flight 103 became a top priority of the U.S. National Security Establishment, one could take that for granted. Confirmation of that from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, January 13th of 1989. A portion of a Jack Anderson column headlined, "The Bombing of Flight 103." Skipping down. Now, the Pan Am bombing has become the top intelligence-gathering priority for the CIA. Our sources say they are prepared to spend, quote, several million dollars, unquote, to find out who is responsible. The flaw in this intelligence-for-cash approach is that it encourages Middle Eastern gadflies to come forward with what the United States wants to hear, that Gaddafi did it. Again, the latest information that has come out, now they're saying, well, maybe it wasn't Abu Nidal, but maybe it was the Islamic Jihad. I personally don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference. All documents relating to Middle Eastern terrorism would have become extremely hot, and in fact, floating the name of the Iranians makes anything having to do with the Iranian deal and Stibom and other things, because recall that Stibom was involved in the Iran-Contra arms shipments, all of that would have been made top secret. Interesting bit of conduct when, in fact, the conspiracy charges, the most important charges against Oliver North, were dumped this past week. Interesting that Judge Gazelle took an interesting, he took a very hostile approach to some efforts by the Christic Institute, the public interest law firm that's gained well-deserved fame in progressive political circles over the last couple of years. They were trying to get some information to Gazelle that would have perhaps provided light or shed some light on the machinations of Oliver North and company. Interesting piece of information about that on the San Jose Mercury News of yesterday, Saturday, January 14th of 1989. An article by Aaron Epstein of the Mercury News Washington Bureau, Dateline Washington, headlined, Conspiracy and Theft Charges Against North Are Dropped. It reads in part, As expected, former national security aide Oliver North, the central figure in the Iran-Contra criminal case, won a dismissal of two major charges against him Friday. Skipping down, in his opening remarks Friday, Gazelle denounced the Christic Institute and its lawyer Daniel Sheehan for trying to intervene in the North case in a, quote, a highly unprofessional and improper, unquote, manner. He said members of the liberal organization who opposed dismissal of any charges called his office in an attempt to influence him and deposited, quote, a large box of factual information, unquote, with the court clerk. He said he would order the papers shredded without reading them. I wonder why. Remains to be seen. Perhaps people will have some thoughts about that. Speaking of the Christic Institute suit, an interesting development, I don't know if it's directly related to an aspect of the December surprise, but worth perhaps mentioning in this context. Again, I don't see any direct relation necessarily, except that obviously all of these operations hook up at a certain level. That is to say, the drugs were used to provide the working capital for Mother Contras, as well as for some of the arms shipments to them. According to the Christic Institute's claims in their lawsuit, an American who has been operating a ranch in Costa Rica, a fellow named John Hull, was a major player in the Contra War and the illegal Contra support effort. According to information developed by Sheehan and company, John Hull and his ranch were used for drug smuggling, specifically cocaine smuggling, by the Medellin cartel, which has received a lot of publicity over the last couple of years. Reading from the Chronicle of Saturday, January 14th, that is to say the San Francisco Chronicle, of Saturday, January 14th of 1989, we find the following story, an AP story, Dateline San Jose, Costa Rica. U.S. rancher with ties to Contras is arrested. And the article reads, John Hull, an American linked to an illegal arms supply network aiding the Nicaraguan Contra rebels, was being held yesterday under charges of drug trafficking and violating Costa Rican national security, his lawyer said. Attorney Ciro Casas Zamora said Hull was formally charged and was being held in the San Sebastian jail where he will remain until a bail hearing on Monday. A source in the Office of Judicial Investigation said that Hull was arrested Thursday for investigation into charges of drug and weapons trafficking and spying for the U.S.-backed rebels fighting the Nicaraguan government. So interesting that John Hull gets popped at about this same time. Whether there's any connection between that and some of the other maneuvering in connection with what I call the December surprise remains to be seen. Again, I just thought I'd toss that in there, perhaps apocryphal under the circumstances. One of the major elements in this working hypothesis, which I've been developing, concerns the significance in terms of the Iran-Contra scandal and American covert power politics in general, of the pizza connection cases. Now, again, I talked a little bit about that at the beginning of the broadcast. I went into it in much greater length last week, and since this will be on the same tape, I'm not going to go into it in the kind of detail I have previously. Suffice it to say that not only Middle Eastern terrorism in a big way, specifically the shooting of the Pope, not only big-time drug trafficking, but the U.S. National Security Establishment and people connected both to George Bush and Ronald Reagan, i.e. Scott Pierce, Bush's brother-in-law, and Donald Regan, the former White House Chief of Staff, would perhaps have been sullied in connection with this case. It also intersects with organized crime, and specifically P2-linked elements of organized crime. By the way, next week, or perhaps the week after, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be downloading a whole bunch of great new translations that I've received from Dave, our Italian translator. So stay tuned for that. The prosecutor in a key case, or the prosecutor, in the Pizza Connection cases, numbers, well, certainly 1, 3, and 4, possibly number 2 as well, as we have hypothesized that they are all the same case, Rudolph Giuliani is the U.S. Attorney for New York. He resigned this past week, or tendered his resignation. It's interesting that in addition to the Pizza Connection case, he was also hearing a case which was dismissed against 11 men for weapons trafficking. These people also were very centrally linked to the Iran-Contra scandal. I went into that in the first part of the December surprise. I'm not going to cover it in too much detail. Interestingly enough, that just this past week, Prosecutor Giuliani announced his resignation. We're going to ruminate about that in connection with some of the cases and some of the maneuvering that appears to be going on behind the scenes in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. Interestingly enough, Giuliani has been mentioned as a possible mayoral opponent of Mayor Ed Koch in New York City, the nation's largest city. An article about Giuliani's resignation appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, January 11th of 1989. The story is Dateline New York headline, Prosecutor Giuliani to quit. Subheaded, high-profile U.S. attorney may run for New York mayor. U.S. Attorney Rudolph W. Giuliani, G-I-U-L-I-A-N-I, who prosecuted mafia chieftains, millionaire Wall Street insider traders, corrupt municipal officials, and drug kingpins, announced Tuesday that he would resign at the end of the month, fueling speculation he might run for mayor of New York City. Giuliani, 44, whose high-profile cases earned him a national reputation as a crime fighter, said he had no definite plans but probably would practice law with Dennison Young, Jr., his longtime deputy and spokesman who also was leaving. But he refused to rule out a race for mayor against Democrat Edward Koch, who in all probability will seek a record fourth term at City Hall this year. Quote, I can't answer that question, unquote. The dark-haired, quick-spoken Republican with a penchant for gathering headlines responded when pressed by reporters about mayoral ambitions. Quote, I have not shut the door on the possibility of running for mayor. Unquote. Skipping down on the story, his office has jailed the leaders of New York's 5 organized crime families, broken the Pizza Connection, unquote, heroin operation, pressed insider trading cases that brought guilty pleas from Ivan Boesky, Dennis Levine, and Drexel Burnham Lambert, and convicted Representative Mario Biaggi and the defense contractor Wedtech on bribery charges. It should be noted that there are a number of interesting connections between Wedtech and not only the Reagan administration, but also the Iran-Contra scandal itself. Skipping down on the story, in recent weeks, Giuliani has suffered several setbacks, including the acquittal of former Miss America Bess Meyerson in a divorce-fixing case and dismissal of charges against 11 businessmen accused of smuggling arms to Iran. A judge declared a mistrial Tuesday in Giuliani's stock manipulation case against GAF Corporation, saying his office had withheld key evidence. Those last couple of sentences again. In recent weeks, Giuliani has suffered several setbacks, including the acquittal of former Miss America Bess Meyerson in a divorce-fixing case and dismissal of charges against 11 businessmen accused of smuggling arms to Iran. A judge declared a mistrial Tuesday in Giuliani's stock manipulation case against GAF Corporation, saying his office had withheld key evidence. Last week, we talked about the dismissal of the charges against the 11 businessmen. One of the names mentioned in connection with that was the late Cyrus Hashemi. Cyrus Hashemi, according to former CIA arms trafficker Richard Brennecke, was in fact one of the people present at the October surprise, or the alleged October surprise. I'm convinced that it was real. The apparent deal cut by the Reagan administration and the Khomeini regime in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages in the U.S. embassy until after Reagan was guaranteed election and Jimmy Carter's defeat was assured. And again, we went into the October surprise in Radio Free America number 31, and we've touched on it in some other connections as well. In particular, a miscellaneous archive show called The Political Resume of George Bush, done just before the recent presidential campaign. Now, the stock manipulation case against GAF, which is just stands for General Analine in a Film, is perhaps worth noting for our purposes here. I'm noting the resignation of Rudolph Giuliani at this time, and I wonder, again, one can't say for sure, but I wonder whether his resignation was in connection with some of these cases. One can only speculate. I wonder perhaps, and again, this is pure speculation and should be taken as such, I wonder if perhaps a deal was cut behind the scenes, whether one perk of one type or other, say perhaps the New York mayoral race or something of that type, was offered to Rudolph Giuliani, and perhaps in exchange for perhaps not prosecuting the Pizza Connection case as fully as he might have. It should be noted that even though a lot of the mafiosi have been arrested, I haven't read anything about any officials from Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner and Smith, or E.F. Hutton having been arrested. And it seems to me that if they were indeed laundering funds for this operation, there should have been some criminal indictments there, too. Now, speculating about Rudolph Giuliani and the interesting timing of this resignation. It comes within a month of some of the most important cases he's ever heard. Pizza Connection 4, the dismissal of the charges against the 11 businessmen, which we covered in the first part of the December surprise, and the interesting case, the stock manipulation case against General Analine in Film, which was declared a mistrial because Giuliani withheld evidence that could have been used by the defense. And again, I wonder if perhaps a deal was cut behind the scenes. The GAF case is worth taking a quick look at because of the person who represented General Analine in Film, and because of the political heritage, the historical background to the company General Analine in Film. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday morning, January 12th of 1989, on the front page of the business section we see an article by Rick Gladstone of the Associated Press. It's Dateline New York, of course, AP. Headline, Giuliani Exit Comes at Key Time. And that is a fact. Skipping down in the article, quote, anybody would have to say his performance as a prosecutor was effective, said Arthur Lyman, a leading attorney who represents Milken and GAF. Milken, by the way, is a fellow who is known for the junk bond market, and GAF in the securities fraud prosecutions. So this is really interesting that Arthur Lyman, who achieved fame of sorts in 1987 as the counsel for the Congressional Committee looking into the Iran-Contra scandal, and who many people, myself included, felt did a very tepid job of questioning the people involved. Most of the important areas were completely avoided or not gone into in any detail. It's interesting here that Arthur Lyman should have been defending General Analine in Film. Now, in the past, we took a look at the fact that it was the law firm that Arthur Lyman worked for that, among other things, drew up the incorporation papers for TCI, the electronic countermeasures, the electronic warfare and intelligence gathering company, which was headed up by none other than Otto von Bolschwing. Von Bolschwing, a key SS officer and participant in the final solution to the Jewish problem during World War II, according to many accounts, the head of Reinhard Galen's North American operation, certainly a key Galen operative, and a person who also was the protector of a woman named Helena von Damm, who selected all of the... Well, von Damm knew him socially, worked for TCI. Von Damm also was responsible for selecting all of the people from whom Ronald Reagan selected his appointments when he was governor of California, functioned in a similar capacity when Reagan jumped to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in 1980. We took a look again at that in Radio Free America number 3 and came back to it also in number 30 as well. Again, Arthur Lyman, his law firm, Lyman himself was in law school at the time, but that law firm drew up the incorporation papers for TCI. That same Arthur Lyman also represented, or no, I guess actually it was the law firm that Lyman worked for, also has represented Henry Kissinger among others. We took a look at the Kissinger connections to the Iran-Contra scandal in Radio Free America number 31. And Arthur Lyman also had represented, among others, Robert Vesco, a key U.S. intelligence operative for many years. Although allegedly a fugitive, in fact, he has been protected by the United States government because of his massive activities on their behalf, notably drug trafficking. We've gone into Vesco and his various U.S. intelligence and drug trafficking connections. We focused on it in a significant way in Radio Free America number 25, among others. We also came back to Vesco in number 29 as well. It's interesting here, again, that Arthur Lyman was representing General Aniline and Film. General Aniline and Film is an interesting company, too. And again, this part of the program is by way of rumination and speculation. The exact nature of the relationships between some of these elements here, if indeed there is a direct relationship, remains to be seen. But the timing of the Giuliani resignation, the fact that Lyman is representing General Aniline and Film, and that Giuliani withheld evidence which caused a mistrial, I think is worth taking note of. General Aniline and Film is an interesting company, and its heritage, too, goes back to the Third Reich, and we're going to ruminate a little bit about General Aniline and Film in a second. Didn't always used to be called, wasn't always called General Aniline and Film. It used to be called American I.G. Farben. Recalled in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, in Radio Free America's 1 and 2, and also in a miscellaneous archive show called South Africa, the Third Reich, and the Bomb, we went into the various machinations of the I.G. Farben Nazi Chemical Company, arguably the single most important individual enterprise in the history of industrial capitalism. Although it's a name that most Americans don't even know, the fact of the matter is the German dyestuffs industry, which is what I.G. Farben came out of. I.G. Farben stands for Interessengemeinschaft Farben Industry, Farben being the German word for color or dye. The German dyestuffs industry is inextricably linked with the history of modern Germany, with the history of the Third Reich, and is one of the, if not the most important, industrial concerns in the history of capitalism. Of General Aniline and Film and what caused American IG to change its name to General Aniline and Film, a good account of that is provided in a book we've used in the past. That book is called The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. It's authored by Joseph Borkin. The hardcover edition was by the Free Press, a division of Macmillan and Company, and it was copyrighted in 1978 by the Free Press. There's also a softcover edition put out by Signet, I believe it was, or perhaps Pocket Books. That was copyright 1979. And of General Aniline and Film and why it changed its name, we find the following account. The outbreak of war on September 1st, 1939, emphasized the fact that time was running short if I.G. Farben's foreign assets were to be successfully cloaked. A week later, the problem was seriously complicated. Edouard Grutert, G-R-E-U-T-E-R-T, I.G.'s chief Wehrmachtsmann in Switzerland, suddenly died. I.G. officials were so preoccupied with the camouflage problem that they could hardly talk of anything else at his funeral. In American I.G., some superficial cloaking steps were taken immediately. American I.G. changed its corporate name to General Aniline and Film Corporation, GAF, eliminating the incriminating I.G. initials. The change, a public relations spokesman frankly explained, resulted from, quote, a belief that German names caused business prejudice in this country, unquote. Hermann Schmitz and Karl Bosch resigned from the board. The Germanic complexion of the executive committee, however, remained. D.A. Schmitz, Rudolf Hutz, and Wilhelm H. vom Rath, R-A-T-H, were all IG-related figures. A bit of background here. Following the German defeat in World War I, German corporations and I.G. Farben in particular became adept at corporate camouflaging, or corporate masking, as it's called. This is the deliberate hiding of the true ownership of a given company in order to avoid tacky considerations, such as the fact that this company is owned perhaps by the Third Reich, as obviously I.G. Farben was. The maneuvering described in that passage by Borkin, who, by the way, worked with James Stewart Martin, the author of All Honorable Men, a book we relied on in the first two Radio Free America shows and in Uncle Sam and the Swastika in particular, James Stewart Martin having headed up the economic warfare section of the antitrust division of the Department of Justice during World War II, Borkin worked with him in that particular department. It's worth noting that IG Farben, after the end of World War II, was nominally broken up into its component companies, although essentially the IG companies continue to wield a powerful, powerful influence on the world stage. People are familiar, for example, with the Bayer Company, the company that developed aspirin, that also developed first heroin and then methadone, originally called Dolefine, a synthetic morphine derivative developed by the Germans to treat casualties in World War II. The Bayer Company, Bayerische, actually means Bavarian, a German adjective. The various member companies of the IG were broken up. The IG itself was broken into its component companies at the end of World War II, but the fact of the matter is that the breakup of the IG was really a superficial ruse, in much the same way as the antitrust laws in this country were around the turn of the century. In a nutshell, and this is an oversimplification engaged in here, something of an oversimplification engaged in for the purposes of brevity here, the antitrust legislation was supposedly aimed at breaking up trusts in which various companies got together and regulated an entire industry. And this was deemed to be illegal. To a considerable extent, the antitrust legislation was hollow in that it broke up the huge trusts, but it didn't really remove the ability of the member companies of the trusts to regulate a given industry. Recall the antitrust legislation was aimed at monopolies, where a single company can develop a total dominance over the market in a given individual area. However, it didn't say that a whole bunch of companies all owned by the same people could do the same thing. So, for example, Old Standard Oil was broken up into its member companies, although no longer did you have one company dominating the petroleum industry, as Standard Oil did. It was owned by the Rockefellers. Instead, it was broken up into Exxon, which is Standard Oil of New Jersey. It used to be called ESSO, E-S-S-O, which was a corruption of S-O, Standard Oil. Standard Oil of New Jersey, the most important of the standard companies. People are familiar with Mobil Oil. Well, Mobil originally was called Saucony Mobil, and before that, Saucony Vacuum. Saucony is Standard Oil Company of New York. That also is a part of the old Standard Company, and it's owned by the Rockefellers as well. Chevron is Standard Oil of California. Amoco is Standard Oil of Indiana. Sohio, Standard Oil of Ohio, and so forth. And although Standard Oil was broken up into its components, they're still all owned by the same people. Again, that's something of an oversimplification, but a very similar thing was done with IG Farben. So when you see General Anilon and Film, it's worth bearing in mind just what that company is and where it comes from. One of the aspects of Mae Brussels' work, which was most significant, was her work on a fellow named Fritz Kramer. Fritz Kramer was a German-born military officer, who served as the plans officer for the Department of the Army from 1949 through 1970, and continued to serve in an important advisory capacity for many years after that. His son, Sven Kramer, is still on the National Security Council and was retained by Frank Carlucci, after Carlucci replaced Oliver North as White House National Security Advisor.